So welcome to Woodbridge School. Thank you very much for coming this evening. I'm Catherine Lana, and I've organised this evening on behalf of Browser's Bookshop. We're very, very pleased to have Patrick Gale here with us this evening. We'll be talking together for about 40, 45 minutes, and then there will be the opportunity for questions. And then we'll have more music, hopefully, as we have the opportunity to have our books signed. So just so that you're aware of the format of the evening. But I know that you're as thrilled as I am that Patrick's here with us this evening, particularly as he's made such a journey to get here. It's taken all day, I think, hasn't it?
It has. I didn't come from Lands End, though, any Honison today, so that wasn't too bad.
And this is part of quite an extensive publicity campaign that you're involved in, which you're not unfamiliar with, I think, because, I mean, for one thing, you've written quite a number of books now. There's, is it 16 novels?
I think it's 16. Yeah, I do lose count. Yeah, two books of short stories. And
a screenplay as well. So quite a lot. How do you find this sort of campaign, then? All this travelling, being away from home?
I really enjoy doing this, meeting readers, because it sort of makes sense of the whole business of writing. I'm not so keen on the earlier bit, where I'm having to do interviews with journalists, because there's always that edge of tension. I'm not quite sure what's going to come out in print. and I'm terribly indiscreet and I say things I shouldn't and then get in trouble.
Oh, you're a dream for a journalist. And you do quite a bit of reviewing yourself in articles as well. So how
I do less, not as much as I used to, I have to say. I don't get asked to review books as much as I did, but I think that's because there's less money in it now. Yes. The paper's increasingly using their own journalists to review.
Yes, that's another topic altogether, isn't it? So, on the journey today, then, how did you fill your time? Because
Twitter, it has to be said, I do a lot of tweeting, and I read. I'm on the very last pages of John Boyne's new novel, which is I can really recommend. It's very naughty. It's a kind of literary thriller about an evil novelist who will stop at nothing, not even murder. I think he's grinding a lot of axes. I'm going to meet him at a book festival in a couple of weeks, and I've already warned him I'm going to get him drunk and make him admit who all characters are based on, because there are a lot of people that I think I recognise.
But a long train journey, that must be an opportunity to do some writing, though.
Normally it would be, but the trains today were very, very crowded. And also, I don't write when I'm promoting. I tend to try to clear my decks totally when a new book comes out, and I focus all my energies on promoting the book and talking about the book, and I think about the next book. And I've discovered it's much better not to start writing too quickly. And so having about a year, 9 months to a year, of not being able to write, ironically, is very good, because it means I'm just thinking and I'm composting the ideas, but I'm not committing anything to paper yet. So I know what my next novel is going to be, vaguely, and I'm really enjoying just letting it grow by daydreams almost. So quite often I'll be sitting on the train staring out the window and I'm thinking about the next book, but I don't put anything down yet.
But you do have to tell us now about your writing process, because it is just fascinating. You can write anywhere, then. You don't need to have a desk and...
I'm incredibly old-fashioned. No, I write in ink, and as proof, I brought along half of the manuscript for this novel. So it is toffee brown. If you're interested, it's Mont Blanc toffee brown is the colour, which I stumbled into by accident because somebody gave me a bottle, and the university archive that takes all my manuscripts away from me got terribly excited. And I thought they were getting excited just because I write in ink, and so few writers do. And they said, no, it's not just that you write in ink, it's that you write in toffee brown ink. So why? But apparently this pigment is the most durable. It lasts far longer than black or blue. Yeah. So if you want your love letters to live forever, write them in toffee brown ink. And I copied a technique of George Eliot's, because I thought, well, she's amazing. I could do worse as a model. Which is that I write from both directions at once. So one side is what becomes the novel. So that's actual recognisable text from the book. But then if you flip it over, this is what George Eliot called her quarry. And that's where I develop character ideas, plot ideas, possible the occasional shopping list or phone number, but by and large, that's the kind of idea larder. Which, and I carry on writing until the two sides meet in the middle somewhere, and then I pick up another notebook and start again.
And who's got the manuscripts after you finish with them? They
stay in Cornwall, I'm rather pleased. They go to the Falmouth University archive. There's a big school of creative writing there. And I'm the only author who writes in ink, which they have in the... They've got lots of other authors, but I'm the only one that does ink. They've got lots of Charles Causley material there, but most of that's in Exeter. But he used an old typewriter. I do use a computer eventually. So when I finish this, I do type it up. But that's almost a creative process in itself, because as you'll see, I pass this around. My handwriting is pretty terrible. And quite often I can't read my own writing, or the cat walks across the page, or something.
And when you've decided then that you've got the material there, that you want to set the book, you want to get it going, what's your regime then? Are you quite strict, or do you have to go
through the I try to treat it like a 9-to-5 job. So I have a little office in my garden, and I try to be at my desk by 9 o'clock, and I write until my brain dries up at about 1:30, and then I start again after lunch. Though usually after lunch there's a definite trough, so I tend to do emailing and letter writing after lunch. And if I'm really lucky and I haven't got anything on in the evening, I'll start again in the evening.
Right.
But it's very unsociable writing, and so if my husband's at home, I tend not to write at night. I can feel really guilty, I just say that if you were away, I could be writing that.
But you've also got a lot of distractions from where you live. I mean, it's a beautiful part of the country, but you're also involved in so many other things.
Well, it's a working farm, for a start, so I'm involved in that. That's less awful than it used to be. When we first met, we grew cauliflowers and potatoes, and cauliflowers require harvesting by hand, and we would have to do that all through the winter, because there's no frost down there, so... Yeah. It's a big part of West Cornwall's economy. And so my writing days would be squeezed. I have maybe 2 days a week I knew I could write, and on the other days I was chopping cauliflowers. But we don't do those anymore, thank heavens, because my back was permanently out.
From
all the repair. But I do work with the cattle, and I drive a tractor when we're doing the barley harvest or whatever.
And we'll probably come back to this as well, but you're also involved in other things. I mean, the cello.
Cello a lot.
So music, yes. Generally.
Yeah, there's one of the oldest orchestral societies in the country is in Penzance, and I'm a cellist, and I'm the secretary of the orchestra, so I'm basically the trades union rep. I'm endlessly sorting out disputes between the players or whatever, which is great fun, and I do a lot of chamber music as well. But I'm also an obsessive gardener, and I think gardening is the main enemy of my writing. Because if I could, I would garden all day, every day, all year. But I have this fantasy that one day I might win a really big prize that would buy me a whole year of gardening. I would be so happy. The garden would be immaculate. But it doesn't happen very often.
No, and we don't want you to stop writing, do we? So we need you to tell us now a little bit about this new book. Take Nothing With You. How did this one come about?
It came about by accident, the way a lot of books do. I was invited to Weston-super-Mare, to the library, to give a reading there. And I'd never been to Weston before, and it's quite an odd place. Does anyone here, because you were by the other end of the country, does anyone here know Weston-super-Mare?
Yes.
A few people do. Does anyone here like Weston-super-Mare? Checking. I mean, I like it now, but when I first went there, I spent about 2 hours, I got there far too early, 2 hours wandering around, and just fascinated, because it's very odd. At first you think, it's seaside, then you realise it's not seaside. And then you see there are lots of people on holiday, but there are also lots and lots of old people's homes, very obvious halfway houses for psychiatric patients, drug rehabilitation centres. A strange place, and a lot of lost, rather damned people wandering around. And when I got to the library in the evening and started my event, I'm very indiscreet, and the first thing that came to my head, which was, thank you for inviting me to Weston, what an awful place. I then hastily backtracked and said, what I mean is, what a perfect place to set a book about a childhood. I thereby kind of doomed myself. I had to go back to Weston repeatedly, having committed to writing a book there. I had to get to know it really well, and I now love it, actually. It is strange, but I'm rather fond of it. And there are some beautiful Regency houses and so on. So it began with the place. And that's happened to me several times before, that often in my books, the place is a character. And because the book centres on a child that has grown up there, the place is almost like an extra parent. It has shaped Eustace, the little hero of the book, and made him who he is. And who he is not very happy, because he's a shy child, not very comfortable in his body, he's a bit overweight. He's got this very odd household, because his parents run an old people's home at home, so he lives surrounded by people with dementia, and is an only child, bit of an oddball, bit sad, but his life is changed forever by music, as mine was, actually, though I was a little younger than Eustace when I discovered music. So this amazingly glamorous woman cellist comes to Weston and gives a recital, and thereafter his fate is sealed. But not only his fate. The book has two, what I think of as literary godparents in the shape of other novels that hover over it. One of them is a children's book, Noel Stretfield's Ballet Shoes. Ah, lots of people nodding, yeah. I read it too. I read it in secret as a little boy, because my big sister had all the Shoes books. And I was obsessed with ballet. I had a secret wish to be a ballet dancer, which I could never admit, because I knew my parents would be horrified. But they did take me to the ballet a lot, so it was really their fault. And I got completely obsessed with this idea of the dedication, the physical pain and the dedication involved in ballet. And I watched that amazing, lurid film, The Red Shoes, with my granny. I was completely terrified, but fascinated. And somewhere along the line, I picked up this image of the ballet shoes filling with blood, because the dancer can't stop dancing. And what I wanted to do was to ally that to the cello. And when you learn the cello, all goes fairly smoothly until you get good enough to learn thumb position. And that was one of the working titles for the book, because thumb position is the cellist's equivalent of the ballet shoe filling with blood, because it hurts. And when you're little and you've got soft, childish skin, you bleed frequently. Because what thumb position is, if I run you through it, pretend I'm holding my cello, half position, first, second, third, fourth, fifth is when your fingers point downwards, but your thumb is still hooked behind the fingerboard. But thumb position is where your thumb comes out and has to be pressed down into the strings. And if you're little, the chances are your cello is quite cheap and you've got steel strings. So it's like putting cheese wire onto a child's finger and then asking them to slide their finger up and down. But it hurt, but I was so excited as a little boy when that first happened. I'm suffering for my art. This is wonderful. So, Ballet Shoes hovers over the book, but the other novel that hovers over it is L.P. Hartley's The Go-Between, because this is very much a story about a boy coming of age and being the instrument of an adult forbidden passion. So, Eustace learns the cello with this amazing woman, but doesn't realise that his cello lessons, which are so transforming his life, are actually providing the excuse for an adulterous affair. I won't say who's involved. It involves his cello teacher and one of his parents, but it leads to a very dark place by the end of the book. There is a cataclysm towards the end. But what fascinated me was I love L.P. Hartley's work, especially The Go-Between, but I wanted, my challenge to myself was to keep Eustace's innocence about the extent of he doesn't really know about the affair. And we keep thinking, oh, surely he's going to find out. And I realised I was playing this game with the reader that actually, no, I would keep his innocence. So as you read the book as an adult, you're seeing a very different story. You're reading it over Eustace's shoulder. So all the story comes through his eyes, but you as an adult are seeing this. But we should talk about the title, because the title is another strand to the book.
Go ahead.
Okay, sorry, you pressed my starting button. The book begins and ends, and throughout different sections, we see Eustace as a grown-up in his 50s. And he's no longer this uncomfortable little boy. He's a very sort of debonair, middle-aged property developer living in some wealth and comfort in London. But on the very first page of the book, he discovers that he has thyroid cancer. And the standard treatments for thyroid cancer are twofold. They usually perform a thyroidectomy, so they can remove your thyroid, as much of it as they can. That's actually remarkably straightforward. But they then tend to give you radioactive iodine treatment. Now, this involves going into a lead-lined room and being given one dose, large or medium-sized, depending on how bad your cancer was, of radioactive iodine. So you were given one pill, but it makes you and everything about you so radioactive that you have to stay in total isolation for up to 48 hours in the lead-lined room. Now, two of my friends had this in quick succession the year before I started writing the book. And I had one of those awful novelist dilemmas, because the friend in me was feeling very sorry for them and worried for them, but the novelist in me was thinking, this is such a great bit of material, and what a wonderful metaphor for somebody at a turning point in their life. It gives them and it gives you an excuse as a novelist to take the character out of their life and put them into suspension. So while Eustace is having this treatment, the parting gift at the hospital from his best friend Naomi, who is a professional cellist, is a little MP3 player on which she has recorded nothing but cello music, and it's all music that has very powerful associations for him. So while he's lying in bed, becoming ever more radioactive, he's listening to this music which keeps taking him back into different scenes from his childhood, and then he's back in the present again. So the whole novel, I don't want to put you off, but the whole novel actually is in the form, it's a musical form, it's a rondo, like the last movement of a Mozart piano concerto. So we keep hearing the main theme, which is Eustace as an adult, having his treatment. And then we go back into related but contrasting material, which are the bits from his childhood. Does that make sense?
That's great, yeah. There are so many things to
follow. So take nothing with you, because you can take nothing with you that you don't mind leaving behind. And in a way, I think it's a therapeutic story, because he goes through all that treatment, he goes through all these memories. And I wanted there to be a sense at the end of the book that he is kind of rinsed of all the bad memories and free to move on into new happiness.
But
you could talk about.
Thank you. So let's go back then to Eustace and his love of music. And when he went to the summer school in Scotland, because that is quite a key point in how he becomes, how he addresses his music, for one thing, but how he grows as a person. So yes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
There's a lot of autobiography and real life tucked away in different bits of this book, and that's a very true-to-life bit. There was a real-life cello teacher, amazing woman, who was a pupil of Pablo Casals. She went on to teach the likes of Stephen Isserlis and Guy Johnson, some very famous cello soloists. And she had a very small school, which Casals had set up, but she then took on, and it was originally in London. When her husband inherited this great rambling house in the Scottish borders, she decamped the whole school from Ladbroke Grove up to this house called Edrum. And there she would have up to, I think, only 8 full-time teenage students. So from 16 onwards, she would basically let you would study the cello a lot, many hours a day, and there would be some arts A-levels. And you know, she was very snobbish. She probably didn't do any science or anything like that. And to make that pay, she very cunningly would run these holiday courses for smaller students, so from 12 to 14-year-olds, and I went on two of these courses. And what I've done is to put a version of these courses and her into the book. And I did so with some trepidation, because she was a larger-than-life character. And so when the book was in a fairly early stage, I got Stephen Isserlis, who's a friend, and some of the other members of her family to read the appropriate chapters to check they weren't offended by it. And what's been so lovely is they're all saying, no, it's very funny because it's her. And on Facebook now, there are lots of Jane's former pupils getting in touch who'd lost touch over the years because of the book. It's bringing them all back together again, which is a lot of fun. But there's a tension for the reader, because you first meet Eustace as an adult and he's clearly not a professional cellist. But then you see all these scenes in his boyhood where he is completely obsessed with the instrument and really believes he might be a professional. That's his secret dream. And so we kind of know, even as it's happening, that it's not going to happen. So the tension is wondering at what point is going to change direction. And of course, Jean Kirwan, this terrifying, amazing teacher, who is his teacher's teacher, as the real-life Jane Coward was for me, like a sort of grand teacher, She is the one who has the power to make him a professional or not.
Yes, but she also has good life lessons about it as well, though, doesn't she?
Yeah, because the thing, and this is very true to life, the thing that Jane Cowan really believed was that music was transformative in many ways. So obviously, if you wanted to pursue it as a career, that's a wonderful thing. But she believed that it was equally important for amateurs, and that if you teach children music from an early age, it gives them a kind of blessing in their life and resilience. But it's become very unfashionable, I think, to talk about failure when you talk about children. We don't want any of our children to fail, and schools have become very against competition in many ways. And I think that's a problem. Actually, and it's no accident that now we've come full circle and primary schools are starting to give lessons in resilience. But in fact, you don't have to look very far to find three pursuits that are very good at teaching children resilience: gymnastics, ballet, and classical music. Classical music, and most of the children who take it up will be hopeless. They just will. They'll have great fun, they'll make an awful noise, and then to their parents' relief, they'll give up after a few years. So only about 5% of the primary school children who take up a classical instrument will be good enough to pursue it into their teens. And of those, probably only another 5% will be good enough to pursue it to conservatoire level, or maybe not even that. It's all about pursuing perfection, knowing you're probably going to fail, but coping with that and picking yourself up and trying again. And before beginning the book, when I was first realising it was going to be about music and about the cello, I took a long, hard look at myself and realised how much I had got from my very intensive early music training, and I realised a lot of it was not to do with music, it was to do with self-control and criticism and discipline, and a lot of things actually I now use in my writing. To be good as a cellist, you have to be, or any string instrument where you're constantly coming to check your tuning, you have to be ferociously self-critical. And you do as a novelist as well. You're constantly policing your own work, constantly cutting stuff out, trying harder. So.
And you do still perform. We've touched on that already. So your music is still very important to you. Has there been, and certainly in writing the book, was there any sense of regret in what could have been or what might have been for you?
No, just relief that I relief that I changed direction. I have a lot of friends who, because I went to a specialist music school from 7 to 13, and a lot of my contemporaries are professional musicians, and I see how they suffer. I mean, it's hard work. It's really hard work, and especially if you're at the sort of soloist level. I think writers are pretty neurotic. Musicians are really neurotic. I've got friends who are opera singers that they throw up every time they're about to perform. They just always do. It's part of their performing routine. And that's no way to live. I couldn't do that. It's terrible for your teeth, apart from anything else.
Right, there were a couple of things that you mentioned then that I'd like to come back to. One was the saying about the books that have touched on this or influenced this. Is that in looking back that you see that those books have influenced the writing of this book? Or was it that you went back to those when you realised the theme that you were going to draw?
A bit of both. The L.P. Hartley theme was there right from the start. It's why Eustace is called Eustace. It's a little sly homage to the Eustace and Hilda trilogy. The childhood sections of the book are set in the 1970s, and that was the last period, really, when L.P. Hartley was hugely popular. He's now cherished by very keen readers and academics, but back in the 1970s, you would have found his books in Smith's, because there was the film of The Go-Between, there was the film of The Hireling, and there was a great big BBC adaptation of Eustace and Hilda. So, in a funny sort of way, I think of him as a 1970s author, although he was earlier than that. That was his golden period. And tragically, that was the period when his reputation was killed off by his own family, when they stopped lovely Penelope Fitzgerald from writing a biography of him. They didn't stop her writing it, they stopped her telling the truth. They wouldn't let her talk about his private life. They wouldn't let her basically out him. And she said, well, I can't write the book if I can't tell readers about the whole man. And I think that actually damaged his reputation, because it made him slide from public view in a way he wouldn't have done if we knew more about him.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't answer your question properly, but the Eustace business that L.P. Hartley was there right from the start. Ballet Shoes came in as I was developing Eustace's character, because there's a key scene very early on where he gets briefly obsessed with ballet before he turns to the cello, the clarinet.
Because I'm quite interested in how you read when you're writing, because are you influenced by other authors when you're writing?
Oh, I am, which is why I don't tend to read any fiction when I'm writing. I'm always terrified I will copy. I might read something by a dead author, a long dead author like L.B. Hartley, but I don't read any contemporary fiction at all when I'm writing, in case I unwittingly copy something. Yes. But also, I usually need to read a lot of non-fiction when I'm writing, because I've never had a grown-up job. There are huge areas of life I know nothing about. So when I'm writing a book frequently, there'll be a character who has a job which I don't understand, and so I have to read a load of non-fiction to understand, or at least to fake that I understand their job. In this case, there wasn't too much of that, because I know about cello pretty well. I just read a lot about Western, Supermare, and...
Okay, but you also draw quite a lot on your own experience, but also family experience, and also you were saying about teachers as well. So real life people in your books,
yes,
which could be quite dangerous. So how have you managed to do that safely?
It is. It hasn't always been safe. I mean, my family. I think any novelist's family live in terror of turning up in a book, and I try not to put mine in too obviously. Although I did once, with Rough Music, I overtly made it about my parents' marriage, because their marriage fascinated me. And I did tell them in advance, I'm going to do this. And my father didn't read my books anyway, so that was fine. My mother did read them and was thrilled, because she said, darling, I'm getting so much mileage. All my friends think I had this adulterous affair now. it gave a great kudos. But I do consciously put elements in, but I censor them as well. I back off. So I'm very aware of my brother and sister's sensibilities. I would never want to do anything to hurt them. But sometimes it's very hard to resist because our family has, there's so much material there to draw upon. So what I did, for instance, with a place called Winter, was to go three generations back and write about the mystery around my great-grandfather, and I can complete a made-up a version of his story that would fit with the known facts. And I'm probably going to go back and do effectively a sequel to that. I know I want to write about when my great-grandfather briefly came back to England as an old man in the 1950s, and my grandmother, his long-lost daughter, rejected him and sent him back to Canada to die. But I'm putting off doing that because an aunt of mine really kind of needs to die before I can do it, because she's going to be a character in the book. my mother thought she was every mother I ever wrote, and didn't realise I was actually waiting for her to die so I could really get my teeth into her. And there's a lot of her, there's a very ambiguous mother in this book, who I like a lot actually, but she's difficult. And there's a lot of my mother in her, but I realised as I was writing that character that it's only a sliver of my mother. It's going to take about six books to process her fully, because she was a big character.
But how do you manage to filter truth and imagination then when you're writing? If you've got such great material that is inspiring you, how do you make sure that you take it on that different tack with imagination rather than wanting to find out more about reality, if you like?
Well, quite often it's a matter of making up a new character and sending them into the material you know. So my novel Friendly Fire, which is very much about my child, well, my teens, it's about being at Winchester College, basically. It's a fantasy version of Winchester College, because what I've done is to imagine what would have happened if girls had been admitted. And I made up a female character and I sent her there as a pupil, and it's the whole story is told through her eyes. So that was a bit like, I was using people I knew and a situation I knew, but it made it totally different seeing it through female eyes. Mm-hmm. And so it changes the polarity. And I quite often play with gender. I'll quite often take a real character, but by changing their gender, it makes them new. My sister loves reading my books, but she says it's very odd for her because She knows she can't read them like a normal reader because she keeps recognizing bits and pieces. And often it's stuff I've forgotten and I haven't realized I'm remembering it. I think I'm making it up. But she will say, oh no, that was the picnic we had when you were about 8. Don't you remember? And so it's very interesting. She's like this kind of librarian of my own memories. She can stand over them. And because she's 10 years older, she remembers things that I can't remember quite so well.
But usually, novelists want to sort of stand well back and say, oh no, it's very much imagination. There's nothing based on fact here. But you are quite open about this.
Oh no, totally. No, I am. And I think it's... I recognised quite early on that I did my best work when I was really confident. And I realised that the best way of being confident was to make sure there's something in each book that's a little bit of me, in a way. Something I know really well, something I've experienced, a place I've been. There needs to be... that's my way in. That's the kind of dot, dot, dot that leads me into it. And I might do that overtly by putting a character who's based on me as a child, like in Rough Music, that's me as a 7-year-old, basically, spying on this story. But I might do it more elliptically by simply having a setting that I know really well. So the whole day through is set in Winchester, which I know like the back of my hand because I grew up there.
Yes.
Well, but I never see the point in disguising that. And when I talk to creative writing students, you often get them saying, oh, is it true you have to write about what you know? And I always say to them, well, no, but turn that on its head and say, just make sure there's something you know in what you write. Mm. So one little seed, it can be something very small, but something that gives you confidence to make the stuff up around it.
But by revealing so much about you and your family, your readers love it, I guess. I do, because it feels that we get to know you as well, which is you know, part of reading today, is we want to know the author as well as the text. And you also tweet, so you're very accessible to people.
Yes, yeah.
How do you keep boundaries, if you like?
I think of it as not really me, it's a version.
Right.
And that's how I keep my sanity about it. It's a version. So if anyone ever says, oh, aren't you ever going to write your memoir? My rather flip answer is, well, I've already done it 16 times. Because every novel I write has so much of me in it. And actually, I think the truth would be rather a letdown. I mean, the official version. It sometimes, though, it does get out of control sometimes. So when I wrote Man in Orange Shirt, my television drama, which wasn't based on a novel, it was an original drama, I used a very painful incident as the germ of the story, a painful incident from my parents' marriage, which was that when my mother was pregnant with me and they were about to move from Camp Hill Prison on the Isle of Wight to Wandsworth Prison in London, my mother tidied my father's desk in a rather bossy way. It's entirely characteristic. She should have left it alone, but she couldn't resist. And she found a wadge of love letters. And she thought, oh, what fun, these from an old girlfriend who's never told me about. She started to read them and discovered they were from his best man, that they had had clearly a passionate love affair, that he'd never been unfaithful, it had stopped before the marriage, but she said it was quite clear, because when she told me this, when I was 21, I pushed her about it and said, well, hang on, how do you know it was really a love affair? And she said, oh, it was clear from the letters that there had been a passion between them, such as your father had never shown me. So I thought, oh God, this is my parents, I don't want to know all this stuff. But I used that, just that germ of a story, and then I changed it, I flipped it. Because in real life, my mother never told my father that she'd found the letters. She burnt them. He never asked where they'd gone. I mean, they had that sort of very English marriage. They didn't talk about stuff. The really awful thing was that because she assumed that meant he was a paedophile, because she conflated the two, as was very common back then, she thought he wasn't safe around children, so she never left any of us alone with him. And I wasn't born yet. I was still in her womb at this point, so I have no memories of being alone with my father till I'm in my teens. And it goes back to those letters. Anyway, I used this material to write that television drama, but twisted it and changed it and so on. But that core bit was true. That didn't cause any problems at all with my brother and sister. They were, because they both knew the story, and that was fine. What really upset them, which I hadn't bargained on, was when I then talked to journalists when the programme was about to come out, and they encouraged me to talk about the real life story. And that caused quite a row, but it was a necessary row, because my brother, I think they were upset about privacy, and they felt I'd gone over the boundaries, and I had, and I should have asked them first, and that was naive of me. But it also obliged them to admit that they had been acting as if saying our father had once been gay was a bad thing. And I challenged them on that and said, well, if you think it was bad for him to be gay, you must therefore think it's bad for me to be gay. Mm. Do you? And they said, well, no. And it was a painful but necessary argument. But it's made me wary now, so I won't go that far. That's why I'm waiting for the aunt to die, basically.
and that was a very popular drama. It was very well received, wasn't it?
I was amazed, yes, because it was commissioned by the BBC very much as a, initially as a quite low-budget drama just for this Gay Britannia series they were planning to mark the decriminalisation of homosexuality having happened 50 years before. But because it ended up being so beautifully made and well cast and all that, it's had this huge afterlife, and it's been shown all around the world, and I'm still getting messages via social media from viewers in Australia and South America and whatever. Amazing, really.
But what was that process like in actually writing specifically for television, for a
screenplay rather than a novel? Well, to the outside world, it looked as if it was my first screenplay, but it wasn't. I'd actually written lots before then, just nothing that had got made. Because the way film and television work in this country, there's not a lot of money. Say producers will acquire the rights to a book, and they then need a writer, a cheap writer, to write them a quick, cheap script of it, which they can then use to raise money for a putative project. And I'd done that several times for books of my own, where somebody had bought the rights to one of my books and needed a script. So I'd got scripts of Rough Music, Little Bits of Baby, two new film projects of Kansas and August, neither of which happened. So I was used to it already, but this was the first time I'd done something that had really gone through the whole process, and I completely loved it. It's very different to writing a novel in that it's so collaborative, because there's so much money involved. They don't let you alone for a moment. There's somebody wanting to see every single draft. Mm. So I don't do anything in ink, because they need to be able to read it very quickly. But I rather enjoyed that. There's lots of feedback, there's lots of bouncing ideas back and forth. And that project has led to a whole load of other things. So I'm now adapting A Place Called Winter, my last novel, as a big BBC series. That'll be four hour-long episodes. Mm. Very expensive, so that's currently, fingers crossed, they're currently trying to attach a director, and we're hoping we've got Francis Lee, who directed God's Own Country, a wonderful feature film, because he loves the novel, so we're hoping he'll do the television thing, and if he does, I think that'll happen. But I've also been adapting the work of other writers, which I've loved doing. I've adapted Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, and I've written a feature film based on an amazing and very naughty Rose Tremaine short story about Daphne du Maurier. Mm-hmm. It's a very Cornish story. It's in her latest collection, The American Lover. And what she does is ingeniously to imagine a backstory for Mrs. Danvers. So how Mrs. Danvers came to be. And she imagines that it was Daphne du Maurier being shown around a big old country house because she was researching Rebecca. And she's shown around by this Polish Jewish housekeeper called Mrs. Danofsky, and the two of them have a passionate affair, because Daphne du Maurier had, it's well attested, these secret lesbian love affairs behind her husband's back. But it's entirely told from the viewpoint of the housekeeper, and it's very clever, because initially it's a big love story, and then it's a story of literary betrayal, because they're almost caught, and so they split up, and Daphne disappears. But then Rebecca comes out, and poor Mrs. Danofsky sees herself travestied on the page as this repellent, terrifying, predatory lesbian, Mrs. Danvers. But then what Rose Tremaine does is to flip it one more time. and show that that very process enables Mrs. Donofsky to become herself again and to be freed of being a housekeeper and go on and be an independent woman. So it's a lovely story. I really hope it gets made. There's two fantastic parts for older, slightly older actresses. So I'm fantasizing about Gillian Anderson as Daphne du Maurier. She'd look very good in jodhpurs and a white brow. So.
But Cornwall, again, we've come back to Cornwall, and we must talk about that.
Yes.
And how that's very much part of your appeal as well, is that people just love reading about Cornwall in your books, as far as I understand.
Yes, I've rather frustrated them by going to Weston-super-Mare at this point.
But Cornwall has become a little bit of a victim of its own success, if you read the tourism reports this summer. How do you view that? I mean, it's so popular for people to come to Cornwall.
Well, thank heavens, because it's almost the only economy there. I mean, the farming and fishing and mining... Well, mining has failed already. Farming and fishing are going much the same way. We're all very nervous. Despite Cornwall idiotically having voted for Brexit, Cornwall is hugely dependent on European subsidies, and I don't know how... The small farms like ours, I mean, a lot of them will go to the wall, I fear. So we need the tourists. But what's interesting is seeing how Cornwall is split. So there are big chunks of Cornwall where tourists don't go. And those tend to be the bits I like writing about. That's why I love Penzance, which is not, although it's very beautiful, it's not invaded the way St Ives is. It doesn't have that many second homes or holiday houses. And it's got kind of a very interesting vibe. It's quite funky, a bit like Totnes. It's full of tree huggers. It's got more pagans than anywhere else in the country. Penzance has so many pagans, it has the only hospital in the country that provides a white witch as well as a Protestant and a Catholic priest. Because they have, so you go in there and you say, oh no, I want the wise woman. They send for the wise woman. She'll come to your bedside with her herbs and stuff.
No. And how did you go to Cornwall in the first place? I'm afraid I don't know that story as to how you found Cornwall.
Through love. When I was 25, I fell madly in love with an architect, and he had a huge job to do up a great big Tudor house on the edge of Launceston in North Cornwall. And we went down there together to look for somewhere to rent, and I remembered how much I'd loved it as a child, because I went there for several key musical holidays, funny enough. And I couldn't afford to buy in London on a novelist's income, but I could afford to buy a tiny house there, which I did. And so that's where I first put my roots down there, and our relationship did not survive, but my love for Cornwall really blossomed, and I stayed put. And then when I met Aidan a little over 20 years ago, I had to move even further west because farmers can't move, and I basically married into the Archers. His family had been there since... they've been there since the Norman Conquest, so they weren't about to up sticks. But it really suits me as a writer. I love the isolation. I love the fact that it takes 5.5 hours to get there from Paddington, because actually that train journey is a very good writing day. If I sit in the quiet carriage and I tell everyone off. I'm completely without shame. I have been known to go out to people and say, is your conversation strictly necessary? And they're so startled, they usually move. But,
and you've invested very fully in Cornwall, because you need to tell us about your festival that's coming up very soon.
Oh, yes. Well, even before this, actually, one of the first things that happened when I was in North Cornwall was I got back involved with the amazing... there are two festivals of classical music at St Endelion, which I took part in as a child, and I started singing at them again as an adult when I moved there, and ended up being chairman of the summer festival and getting hugely involved in all the kind of music and arts politics. And I then became a director of a charity we set up to try to create more arts events through the rest of the year. And while being on that board, I was then asked, would I start a book festival? Because I was the only one on the board with any book know-how. So I have, and it's our sixth year of the North Cornwall Book Festival. I can highly recommend it. It's the first weekend in October. I'll leave these leaflets here. And I'm particularly excited because I spend all year travelling around book festivals and whatnot, and I meet other authors, and the ones I really like, I can invite them now to my festival. So I'm thrilled this year I've got Anne Enright coming over from Dublin. She's never been to Cornwall before, and I'm going to be interviewing her, and I can't wait. It's lovely. And so I'm very involved in that, and the orchestra at the far end. And I just feel passionate about Cornwall's art scene, not just the literature, but the whole kind of holistic approach to the arts. Because people don't realise who go there on holiday that it's so poor. It's routinely either the second or the third most impoverished region in the whole of the UK, desperately poor. And you really see that if you go in February when there are no tourists about, because the tourists bring money with them and they see each other and they think, oh, it's nice here, all these Bowdoin bags and things. That's artificial. The real Cornwall is so poor. Just up the road from where our book festival happens, there's a village where the average income is so low that most of the children there have never been to the theatre. And the nearest theatre is less than an hour away, but their families can't afford to put them on the bus to go to Plymouth for the evening or whatever. I mean, it's desperate. So the Arts Council love us for doing this because we have 2 days totally devoted to children's authors, and we can bring kids in buses and bombard them with wonderful literature.
Brilliant. Right, well, I've had my quota, probably. So has anybody else got any questions? And we'll repeat it for the rest of us, just so that we've got it clear. Has anybody got a question to start us off?
Don't be shy.
Is
Notes from an Exhibition based on a real artist? Yes and no. The character at the centre of it, Rachel, is actually based on a poet, wonderful poet whose name I always forget, but I have remembered tonight, Anne Sexton. Anne Sexton is an amazing Canadian/American poet who had bipolar disorder and wrote really powerfully and wittily about the conflict between being a mother and being an artist. And I was hugely inspired by her, and her character comes across in her poem so powerfully. And I then realised when I started developing the character of Rachel and realising she was going to be a painter and live in Cornwall, oh, everyone's going to think it's Barbara Hepworth. So I then had to bring Barbara Hepworth in as a character to show that Rachel wasn't Barbara Hepworth. And interestingly enough, that novel is now being made into a film, not written by me. I said I didn't want to write the script. I couldn't. I tried. It was too hard. They commissioned a wonderful script from a playwright, Helen Edmondson, and I read her script the other day, and it made me cry, even though I know the story. It's really, really good. But she's been very clever, the way she's kept the very difficult, odd structure, but she's changed the structure a bit. And she's removed, there's no Barbara Hepworth in the film. Shock horror. There was I fantasizing that Julie Waters would be perfect to play Barbara Hepworth. No, she's very cleverly conflated the Barbara Hepworth's character and her role in the story with the nasty man who rapes the heroine in her teens back in Canada and made them one person. It works really, really well, anyway. But no, she's not based on a real person. She is, however, based on lots and lots of artists I know, because I live in an artist colony. I'm surrounded by painters and sculptors and potters. So a lot of the material is sort of mixed up in her. But lots of people read those descriptions of the paintings and say, oh, it's so-and-so, oh, it's so-and-so. And I always say, well, yes, it's all of them.
Yes.
In A Place Called Winter, I remember so clearly about the opening up the virgin land. Farming help you?
Hugely. No, hugely. I was saying earlier how I always put a bit of me into every book. Well, in that book, where the facts ran out, where the knowledge I had ran out about Harry Kane, was the moment he arrived in Canada. I knew the date he got there, I knew where his eventual farmstead was, and I knew that he had the sense to spend a year learning to be a farmer at Moose Jaw somewhere. But those are all my facts. So I then had to project myself into his shoes and think, well, how would I have coped? And I, of course, had this ready material to hand because I had to learn to farm at an age when I really wasn't expecting to learn to, you know, bang in fence posts and round up cattle and things. And so all the descriptions of his aching back and his calloused hands, that's all very true to life. The great challenge when we televise it is going to be how we recreate virgin prairie. Because I don't know if you know Canada, but there's very little, if any, virgin prairie left. I think we might have to grow some on purpose or do it with CGI. But what was hugely moving when I was researching the book was that I had the map coordinates for where his farm was, and I went to Winter, which is now a ghost town, but the land he ploughed by hand with an ox and a little push plough is still a farm. So it didn't go to, all his labour didn't go to waste. Many of the farms did. Many of the farms went back to being rough ground because they weren't on good land to start with. But he was lucky in his land, I think.
Anyone else? Yes, over there.
Hi.
You write for grown-ups, but childhood features are not in your work. Have you ever been tempted to write for young children?
I have, but I think I've got, my sense of humour is a bit smutty.
So the question, the question was writing for a younger audience.
Yes, I. So this book, I can imagine plenty of teenagers will enjoy reading this book. And I did say to my publishers when I first delivered it, do bear in mind I would be perfectly happy if you want to do this as a double edition, do a parallel YA edition. And they decided that that was fine, only the kind of adult elements of sexuality were maybe a bit too much. But fashions change remarkably fast, and most YA fiction now is very out there, and it's full of all sorts of sexuality and stuff. So I think this is quite tame. I'd be thrilled if it got read by children. I know that my earlier novel, Friendly Fire, and Rough Music are regularly taught in schools for the A-level age group, which is great. But I can't imagine actually writing, setting out actively to write a children's book. But maybe a YA book, I might. I don't know. But what puts me off is seeing how hard YA authors have to work. They have these huge book tours. I mean, my book tour is quite extensive, but you know, theirs is really hard work because you go into one school and give the same talk 6 times. And, yeah. They get quite rich, though, so it might be worth doing.
Anybody else?
Yes, thank you.
Probably my favourite book of yours that I've read is Notes from the Exhibition. Mm-hmm. Because in lots of ways, I thought the male characters were wonderful. I thought the husband was somebody I completely warmed to and was very convincing. And I loved Hedley. I was just wondering.
Poor Hedley. Funny, some of them, well, Morwenna, of course, the daughter in that book, I did bring back in A Perfectly Good Man, because I found I was worrying about her, because I'd left her in this terrible place, and I had to kind of bring her in another book to reassure myself she was going to be okay. Hedley, it's funny, you've now made me think I should worry about Hedley, maybe I'll bring him back. I might, I have done it before, it's very tempting. I worry about being sentimental. Sometimes I think that you should just leave the characters alone and start afresh. But I'm thrilled to hear you say you like the men, because I find men terribly hard to write. Well, you're very kind. I often have to identify as I'm writing a book if there's a character that's very like me, very close to me emotionally. And if they are, I know I have to work extra hard on that. And Hedley, funnily enough, was very close to me. His mindset and his position within the family and everything was so close to me that I didn't try, in the first draft, I hadn't tried hard enough. And he was very thin. I had to put a lot more in there. He's lovely in the film version. She's given him some extra stuff to do, which I like. But the interesting thing about Anthony, the Quakerly father, is I think he's quite ambiguous. I've often had arguments with this about people when we're talking about parenting in that book, and people say, oh, Rachel's such an awful mother. Well, actually, I think Anthony's a pretty awful father because he puts his wife before the children at every turn. Whereas she, in her very damaged, weird way, does focus on the children almost to a scary extent, at least once a year. You know, they get their birthday out of it. I know.
Probably just got one more, yes.
The Sugar Quintet is almost a character in this book, and I have to keep listening to it. And I,
Are you a master of music at the school or something?
No. Okay. I've read somewhere that it was one of the all-time favourites on Desert Island Discs, I would like you to talk about
the Schubert Quintet. It's an extraordinary work. I was very, very lucky to be able to learn it. The year before I started work on the book, a local string quartet they wanted to play it, and I was the available second cellist, which is why Eustace plays the second cello line, because I know that line really well. And it is a very, very strange and wonderful piece, and it was written when Schubert was so desperately ill. And yet it seems to have no suffering in it. It's been rinsed somehow. It's a piece of magic, really. And I had to cut an awful lot out. There was far too much technical stuff in the first two drafts of the book, and I didn't want to scare off the non-specialist reader. But what I love is when readers are now saying, I didn't know much about classical music, but after reading this book, I want to hear the music. So I've set up a Spotify playlist. Ask a 12-year-old, they'll tell you what Spotify is. All the music that's in the book, it's now available. If you go onto Spotify and you search for Take Nothing With You, there is a list there. You may not like the performances. I keep saying to people, there are many different ways of playing Bach, and Casals isn't the only one to get it right. And you shop around. I'm glad you liked it.
I think, for me, that was the most special thing about the book, was that you made learning to play an instrument so exciting, so beautiful, so magical. It did actually make you want to take up an instrument, not being musical myself. And it was just a very clever way of writing about quite practical things.
Well, it's a funny combination, isn't it? Because on the one level, playing an instrument is so technical and practical.
Yes, for me, yes.
But on another, music is so emotional. And it's very much, that's what appealed to me about writing about a book for this age group as well, that from the age of 10 to 13, you're a kind of volcano of emotions, most of which you don't express, and yet music gives voice to them.
Yeah.
And then you have the double bind, which is that, of course, because you're so young, if you're any good at the music, you find yourself playing pieces which are expressing emotions you yourself have yet to experience. So there's quite a funny scene where Carla is teaching him the slow movement of the Rachmaninoff cello sonata, which is incredibly sexy stuff. Clearly, it's deeply charged, but deeply erotically charged. Not a thing you would expect a child to be able to do. And Carla starts teaching him, and then she tries to explain, and then for a moment she says, you're just too young yet. And never mind, let's make it sort of about ice cream or something. So she sort of teaches him to fake it. And that's absolutely based on a piano lesson I remember having when I was learning a piece of Chopin. My teacher, I had the notes, I could do all that stuff, but clearly the feeling wasn't there.
Yeah.
And my teacher basically said, look, you're just too young, we're going to have to fake it, just copy me. It was very interesting. It was like learning dance steps when you don't really know what dancing is for.
Brilliant.
Okay, well, we have reached our time, so hopefully we will get Etienne and her teacher back to give us a little bit more of an accompaniment. But we will now have the opportunity to have our book signed. And if you've been tempted by any of the other titles mentioned as well, there's a little book table over there. So think about those Christmas presents. We are getting that way now.
And if anyone wants to look at the manuscript, I will pass it around. Just don't let it leave the room.
It's very special. And we're going to stay here for the signing. So if you make an orderly queue at some point somewhere around here, then we'll do the signing here. But please do join me. Do this.
No, I'm afraid it's black ink. The brown ink is too slow to dry.
But we do need to say thank you together for a fantastic evening. So thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.